Thank you for being here for a second day. I think I'm going to get going. Let me start by just explaining a couple chapters of the book that I'm going to skip over that I think are just as good as some of the other stuff, if I might say so myself. But I'm going to skip over today. One of the things that I try to look at is the use of the word steward. Christians are really fond of the word steward. And I try to make the argument that it's sort of a word without meaning any longer. That everyone's a good steward, but good stewarding doesn't actually mean anything any longer for most Christians. And in fact, I did a little bit of historical research on the word, and the word steward that we use in Christian circles only goes back to the 17th century. It's actually not used very often in Christian history. It's a very new word, and particularly the idea of stewarding natural resources. So I look at some of the problems with that word, and particularly a steward has often been used in the context of slavery throughout Christian history. And so it's only, like I said, in the last 400 years or so that Christians have tried to apply it to natural resource usage or to steward the creation. But it's that vacuity of that term that causes me to have some problems. If I were to go into your church today, I would say, are you all good stewards of the land? Everyone would raise their hand and say yes, and I'd say, well, how do you show that? And there'd be a lot of hands going down very quickly. And so what I try to replace that with in another chapter is the idea of humility, that we need to think about ourselves as humble servants, similar to Noah and similar to Jesus. So make a big deal about Jesus being a humble servant and make a big deal about Noah and the Noah story, Noah being a humble servant both of whom are willing to sacrifice. And the mark of servanthood is sacrifice, and how that is a really important piece of understanding ourselves as human beings, is this ability to serve other people as well as other creatures. And so I'll leave that behind, but that's another, I think, piece of the book that might be provocative to some Christians, if particularly those who don't know their history, but the idea of sort of substituting a word like steward for something just as simple as humble servants. And what does that do for us as we think of ourselves as humble servants of God rather than stewards? And does that get us into a better place? Okay. For example, one of the things I try to say is that thinking of ourselves as humble servants might help us understand creation as a gift of grace rather than not. Whereas sometimes when we think of being stewards of the land, we think that we have to manipulate the land, we have to change the land, we have to do something to it. And we become far more prideful at times with our successes than we are humble. So, but what I want to do this morning, I'm going to skip over that and skip over the chapter on economics and talk a little bit about food and try to think about how it is that Christians might be more hopeful. And so I'm going to start with two questions that I would like some crowd participation on, and then we'll talk about some of the things that I think about when it comes to food. So question number one, do you think there is any difference between how the average American eats and how the average American Protestant Christian eats? So think about average American, how he or she eats. Think about the average person at your church that calls himself or herself a Christian and how that person eats. Similarities, differences, exactly the same. This doesn't have to be rhetorical. It can be out loud. Same?
Very, very much so. There might be just a small handful of people that are more conscientious about this temple that God has given us. But far and wide the majority.
Okay. So we have one vote for the same. You had your hand up here.
I was going to say, we have an obesity problem in this country. As you talk about the average American. The mm-hmm. average American is obese. Mm-hmm. Or getting closer to being mm-hmm. obese. I think I see some similarities in church, but I think more conscious people, are even if they're overweight, like I am, they're mindful of it and try to eat smart and intelligent mm-hmm. and healthy.
Okay.
If you honor your body, you're conscious of the good things to eat and avoid as much of the grease and fries as possible.
Okay. So somehow Jesus would be anti-fries and greasy food. So we sort of have this kind of impression of Jesus the nutritionist, right?
Like you said, I think the people that we know in churches that might eat better or eat differently aren't doing it out of my instinct wants to say stewardship motivation. Aren't doing it out of a servant motivation. They're just doing it to have a healthier heart, live longer. might look better in a swimsuit. You know, I don't think it's, I've never heard of a Christian in my church until I kind of introduced new circles that we've been talking about, say, I'm going to the farmer's market because it pleases God. You know, I think they go to the farmer's market because they think it's healthier and they'll feel better.
Okay.
I have my view as a person.
Yeah, and so let me just mention that before I get to the other two hands. I mean, in the introduction to this chapter, I won't be reading that part, but there is a definite American spirit on food that we see in very few countries around the world, where eating has to do with how one looks rather than how one feels or how one's body works. And particularly as someone married and living in Southern California, the body image issue of a certain type and a certain slenderness and a certain fill-in-the-blank is more radically promoted, say, in Southern California than it would be where I grew up in Northern California, where athletic body types look far different than sort of fake prosthetic body types down here. And we sort of think about that primarily rather than asking some other questions that we'll get to in a second. So thank you. Yes, up here.
If you travel to other countries and then come back, it's so obvious, you know, that people are so much different here. Also, along the subject, Jesus was criticized for
Well, I wouldn't say he was criticized as a glutton. He was criticized in Luke as being a partier, right? He was always at a party. You know, it's like every other story, Jesus is eating and drinking at a party with people. And I don't think, as some of our congregations are sort of very anti-alcohol, which has some good reasons for it, Jesus seemed, at least in the Gospel of Luke, to be a very interesting character who spent lots of times at lots of parties with people. But I think there's something about this. If we sort of, let me ask the second question, which is, should the average American Protestant Christian eat differently than the average Christian? And not necessarily just in the sense of maybe we should eat more chard and less fries, but this question maybe is more central, which is, should eating be a way we proclaim our faith? You know, we spend, I forgot what the number is, but we spend years of our life eating. If you sort of add up all the time that is spent eating in one's life, it's years. If you then think about all the time that it takes for a farmer to produce the food, for workers to pick the food, for it to be shipped or processed, we're talking about, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of hands that are involved in that. We are now part of a larger ecology, a larger web of life, and not just us in the grocery store any longer. It's something far more grand. And so let me ask that question and see if anyone wants to respond. Should eating be a way that we proclaim our faith? So should somehow our Christian walk include our day-to-day eating? Yes, please.
So I'm going to go back to Daniel. And in my mind, there's the greatest example, because Daniel was in a culture that said, oh, no, if you're going to be under the king's cover and protection, we're going to feed you lots of protein, eat your burgers and steaks.
Right.
But he said, no, you know, God will take care of us and just give us vegetables, we're good. And, you know, so you know, even though we may want those steaks and all those proteins, and there's an awareness. And I think in our culture today, we're more aware of the things and the effects of these things upon us. So as a person who's had an MI, a triple bypass, I learned too late that if you drink a lot of soft drinks, like one a day, it has an effect on your heart. And so, you know, this stuff is coming out all the time for us to be aware of and to be passing on.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else? Do you think all the time that you spend eating during your lifetime and my lifetime, should that somehow mark us as Christian people? Or is Christian stuff just other things and not eating?
It should be, in my opinion, because several times in the Bible it's stressed that our bodies are the holy temple of God. And the Holy Spirit resides there. And he doesn't want to be bumping around against a lot of fat cells or other stuff. And so in order to honor God in the fact that he gave us this vessel, I should take better care of it in eating foods that will nourish me instead of satisfy me.
Okay. Yes, please.
Well, and then there's Christian fasting, which would be different than a secular fast. We have reasons differently. That has to do with the Christian witness, perhaps, as far as food goes. How that affects the environment. Like you have
Yeah, it does, in quite a number of interesting ways. I won't be able to cover them all now. But one of the things that I talk a lot about in this chapter in food, I'm going to share some of it in a few minutes, is we all celebrate this thing on Sunday called the Eucharist or the Lord's Supper or the communion table, whatever your particular history or your denominational history calls it. We practice certain types of table manners. We practice certain types of prayers. We practice certain types of social arrangements. We practice certain types of manners and in just a general sense. And yet we seem to think that those just apply to Sunday and they don't apply to the rest of the week. What is interesting in the first century is that the agape meal that the Eucharist ends up coming out of was practiced every day, right? Because the slaves decided if this Jesus guy was really who all these people say it is, we're going to get together every night and celebrate that, that we are free people even though we're slaves during the day. And then eventually by the end of the second century, it's sort of the middle of the second century, so it sort of turns into a one time a week kind of activity. But the initial separation between what was going on at the Lord's table and what was going on in the rest of your life was very nil. It was what was going on in God's sort of moments, the Christian moments of the Eucharist, affected everything else. And so Paul has this very interesting exchange with one of the churches in the Roman Empire about, I will give up meat eating if that causes someone else to stumble. There's a moral condition built into that society around meat, and we'll talk more about that in a few minutes, that how then we think about food, if it causes someone else to have problems, should we think about that? And so I talk about that in the chapter about how we have farmers, and we have migrant workers, and we have lots of folks around the planet who are impacted heavily by the decisions we make every day, and they are being either treated justly or unjustly by our food choices, and yet we pretend like that's not existing at all. So, and you know, unless you're one of those very few people left in America that is raising all of your food and you brought it all with you to California for the Bible lectures, there's no real moral high ground for us, right? We have to sort of admit that we're part of this larger food ecology web and ask ourselves some really important questions as Christians to say, is this thing that we practice all the time really witnessing to who Christ is and the hope that might come from the resurrection? So let me first try to identify three idols that I think that Christians and other Americans worship as we think about the food system. So in the chapter, I talk about a lot of different social problems dealing with farmers and migrant workers and some others. And then I come to this idea that there are three idols that we tend to worship: the idol of control, the idol of efficiency, and the idol of convenience. That in our food system, control, efficiency, and convenience are really the dominant idols, if you will, that control, or not control, but that sort of maintain our food system. So let me give you one example of each, and then I'll get into how we might combat that with hopeful eating. Okay? So, for example, on control, think about how we feed and slaughter animals. Let's take chickens, for instance. The American desire for chicken breast meat has spurred scientists to genetically engineer and breed chickens that metabolize most of their energy into large breasts. In order to maximize this sort of metabolism, most chickens in America no longer are allowed to walk around looking for food that they have eaten traditionally on the farms of American generations past. Instead, they are fed a precisely engineered diet of starch, amino acids, and antibiotics, which help grow large breasts quickly. This sort of control allows most chickens to grow at basically the same rate, which subsequently allows for a sophisticated automated slaughterhouse to process chickens of essentially the same size. Everything's got to be the same size if it's going to go through this sort of slaughterhouse. This sort of control allows many Americans access to just the sort of meat they desire at prices that generally fit well within a food budget that we do not want to see swell to a point that it disrupts expenditures on other quote-unquote necessities, like our mobile phones, high-speed internet, and streaming entertainment services, right? Those are necessities, right? This sort of control does not come without a cost, however, as the massive amount of energy that is now metabolized into breast meat causes at least two significant problems for the modern broiler chicken. One, the mere weight of the chicken's breast is often too much for the chicken to handle, and thus its hips and legs tend to break if not slaughtered first. Two, because so much of this metabolic energy is being spent on muscle development, the average chicken that Americans eat is producing fewer antibodies that might protect it from diseases. It is more likely to contract living in a confinement chicken coop with 40,000 or so other chickens. But do not worry. Scientists are attempting to genetically engineer disease-resistant chickens to combat just this problem. Okay? So as we think about this, it's not just a personal health issue, because the chickens of today, actually, even though they have bigger breast meat, they're actually fattier than they were 50 years ago. So those of you in the room that maybe grew up on farms, the chickens you ate then are far more lean and better for you. The chickens that we eat now, while they're producing more, they're actually fattier than not. So as this sort of push towards more protein, Americans are actually eating more fat rather than they're eating more good protein, per se. So one example of control. Does that kind of make sense? All right. The idol of efficiency. Let me give an example of that. Linked to the control is the idol of efficiency. Efficiency is so prized by American industry that we presume that any lack of efficiency, no matter in what phase of our lives, means a loss of profit. I mean, you think about that, right? Why eat lunch with colleagues when you could get work done while you eat? Why not genetically engineer a plant to be a uniform size so it can be picked by a machine rather than a human being? That's why corn is all the same size. In a world where the phrase time is money has such cultural cachet, it is no wonder that slowing down to eat seems like a considerable waste of time and thus money. This mantra is manifest in myriad ways in the food production industry, where the downward price pressure can only be met by the cost cutting that comes through more efficient means of production, whether that be more efficient workers, equipment, or even inputs of food. As one scholar puts it, with rapid advances in breeding, production, and shipping, a ham or a chicken can now be manufactured as uniformly and precisely as the frozen pizzas or fast food burritos they wind up in. There's something wrong with that, right? When something living can be produced in the same way as something that is processed. Why should plants and animals not be grown or raised to be as efficient as we want them to be? As we'll discuss later on, efficiency even creeps into the amount of time we spend eating, right? I mean, how often do you actually spend eating with other people? And then finally, convenience. I'll give you one example of the idol of convenience. The last member of this profane trinity is convenience. If it is perceived waste of time to eat lunch with colleagues, then it is certainly inconvenient to come home at the end of a long day and make dinner for the family. The rise of fast food, drive-through restaurants, frozen dinners, ready-made meals, and so-called convenience stores demonstrates that when we actually do eat, we want the meal to be as convenient as possible. The rise of convenient food is driven as much by producers as it is by consumers. From the vantage point of producers, as one scholar puts it, in a food economy geared towards even lower prices, selling convenience has become the food industry's most important means of making money, right? You're busy. Treat yourself to something that's easy. And as many Americans have moved further away from their workplaces and quote-unquote live so many hours a day in their cars on their way to some event, we have been willing to exchange homemade meals for less flavorful and less healthy items because of their, quote, cheapness, uniformity, relative safeness, and huge convenience, right? Food safety in the sense of what poisoning is or is not has actually gone up as we've gone to more convenient foods rather than when people are cooking at home. Thus, the rise of items like meal replacement bars and single-serve yogurt in a squeezable tube, because who really has the time to be bothered by the time it takes to actually eat a meal or to eat yogurt out of a single-serve cup? While you can go to the grocery store and purchase the ingredients for a meal, if you lack the time, you can purchase any number of ready-made meals that only require reheating, if that. And if you find yourself in a pinch, you can always buy a, quote, meal for the family in the convenience store that is managed by your local gas station on the way home from work, right? But as the famous Christian poet Wendell Berry argues, it is more than this. We have made a social ideal of minimal involvement in the growing and cooking of food. This is one of the dearest liberations, he calls it, of our affluence. In a culture dominated by these idols that prescribe this sort of liberation, cooking from scratch may very well be a subversive act of the profoundest sort. So students ask me all the time, how often do you cook? And I say, every day. How often do you cook 2 or 3 hours a day? And I say, not as often as you think, because I'm all right with leftovers. But the average American is not all right with leftovers. But the idea of cooking at an end of the day becomes a subversive act because you are doing something the culture says is not to do. You're supposed to veg out in front of a TV, not engage the rest of your family, not make cooking a social event the way it has been for thousands of years. Okay, I don't have time to go through it now, but I argue just after this that our devotion to these idols has led to the cheapest calories in human history, right? Americans pay less for food than any other industrialized nation or any other nation on the planet, by far. We spend roughly 10% of our total income on food. Europe, the closest European neighbor, is usually in the 14 to 15% range, right? And in the developed nations of Western Europe. But as well as creating the cheapest calories in human history, we also have the most egregious food wastefulness problem of any human civilization that has ever existed. Research shows that we in America waste between 40 and 50% of the food that we grow. And so you think about that in the food insecurity situations that we have in the U.S. and the profound hunger that we have around the planet. When it comes to food waste, Christians are just as bad as non-Christians. When you think about the last time you were at a church potluck, how much food was eaten and how much was just discarded. That to me is sort of this very troubling sign that we Christians are not thinking about something as simple but as impactful as food from a biblical point of view. Okay, we live on a planet now where any given day there are 1 billion people starving and there are 1 billion people who are obese. Never before in human history have we had so much suffering and so much largesse at the same time. And I think we should ask ourselves as Christians, is that okay? All right? So the question for me then in the rest of this book, or at least in this couple of chapters, is how might Christians demonstrate resurrection hope through their eating? Well, one, it's just simple. We stop disconnecting the table manners we practice at the Eucharist from the meals we eat the rest of the week. In other words, we sort of return to this ancient Christian idea that what we do on Sunday matters to what we do the rest of the week. Sunday is not separated from Monday through Saturday, or even Sunday morning from the rest of Sunday at times. So let me briefly share 5 lessons that I articulate more fully in the book that will give us some ideas of what hopeful eating might look like. Okay? So the first one. When I often ask my students, where does their food come from? What do you think they say?
The grocery store.
The grocery store. 99 times out of 100, except for that one or two students that lives in a rural environment, they'll say the grocery store, right? Ralph's, Vaughn's, Safeway, one of the local California chains, that's who brings me food. We have forgotten our connection to the land in less than a generation or just more than a generation. I mean, you think about this. My grandmother grew up in rural Arkansas with no running water and no electricity, to now we have high-speed internet and things that she never thought possible. Grew all of her food, to now she uses the grocery store only. That happened in the span of less than 50 years. It really is a feat of human ingenuity at some perverted level to think that we've accelerated our understandings of ourselves and our disconnection from the land so quickly. But I want to argue that hopeful eating should remind us of our connection to the earth. Humans are truly people of the soil. If we look at the Genesis 1 text, we are the Adam, the soil people of the Adamah, the fertile soil. The sometimes cynical author of Ecclesiastes puts it this way, surely the fate of human beings is like that of the animals. The same fate awaits them both. All go to the same place. All come from dust, and to dust all return. That's another piece of the Genesis 2 story as well. This fact is not only reaffirmed when we partake of the Eucharistic elements, but every time we place food in our mouth, because everything we eat has its beginning in the soil. No amount of chemical alteration, synthetic derivation, or technological sophistication in the food production chain that serves the idols of control, efficiency, and convenience can alter this fundamental biological truth. Therefore, Christians should be the first to contemplate the moral and theological dimensions of our food, where it comes from, and how it got to our plates. Instead, we are often, too sadly, the very last to do so. So here's a sort of a moment in our cultural history where Christians should be the ones reminding of our traditional stories that we are connected to everything God has made, and yet we have fallen into the same trap that the rest of America has. Our stuff comes from the grocery store. It doesn't actually come from the land. Okay? So that's point number one. We come from the earth. Maybe we should remember that. Number two, hopeful eating should remind us of our interdependence with the rest of creation. I mean, think about it. We cannot celebrate the Eucharist without the earth's capacity to bring forth wheat and grapes. The fact that we cannot create our own energy by absorbing the rays of the sun and transforming them into sugars like plants means that humans, like many other creatures on this planet, necessarily depend on countless non-human creatures merely to survive from one day to the next. I mean, hunger, world hunger would be over if we had chloroplasts in our skin, but we don't. And so do we actually reflect on the fact that we are interdependently linked with everything else that God has created? This should give us pause and compel us to think about food's moral and theological implications. And yet, through the priests of advertising who speak for the idols of control, efficiency, and convenience, we implicitly believe that we rely on the grocery store for our food, not a farmer, and certainly not other creatures, especially the tiniest ones that make the soil bring forth food, right? If those of you who are from farming communities, you know the soil is not dead. The soil has to be alive in order for seeds to actually germinate. Through deeper contemplation, we perceive not only our interdependence, but also the costs associated with life on this planet. As I go through the rest of this chapter, talk about, you know, one of the things that's interesting being a biological creature at the top of the food chain is you rely on everything else below you. Life is costly in the universe God has made. Something has to die in order for something else to live. And yet, do we spend any time reflecting upon that? And I think too little time is spent in Christian churches reflecting on just that basic fact that the universe God set up has life and death intrinsically linked in these sorts of ways. And what sort of respect do we pay to that when we are eating? Okay, so that was number two. Number three, hopeful eating should remind us of the nature of our ontological dependence on our relationship to God, per se. Just as the Eucharist reminds us on Sundays of the divine grace that sustains our very existence, daily eating should cause us to be cognizant of this in a very specific way. While we may grow plants to eat and thus believe that we have done something to maintain our existence, right? I'm growing tomatoes in my backyard, all right? I'm doing something good. The truth is, though, I did not create the sun that provides the energy that allows plants to be the basis of the food system upon which I completely depend. The question of who or what created the sun that gives plants the energy that is the basis of our food system should prompt us to ask, upon whom do we ultimately depend? Thinking that we ultimately rely on the grocery store or seed companies or fertilizer manufacturers or even farmers for our food misses the ontological mark. For Christians, each meal, and I mean this, each meal, should be a reminder that we ultimately depend upon God, not human ingenuity or technology, for every bite that we take. This is one of the principal lessons that God, providing man in the wilderness, was supposed to teach the Israelites, and it was reemphasized by Jesus feeding the multitudes. But I think, unfortunately, too many contemporary Christians have easily forgotten this lesson. I think if you were to go to your home church and ask, where does food come from, they would be just like my students. It comes from the grocery store. We have lost just the basic insight to say food comes from God, and it could make us better people if we were to think about it in those sorts of terms. Okay. Number four, hopeful eating should remind us to be humble. As I had mentioned a few minutes ago, I make a big deal about the virtue of humility and its role in the life of Jesus and the role in the story of Noah. The Eucharist exhorts us to be humble as we recognize our sin and celebrate the work God did in the resurrection of Jesus to conquer death and redeem us back to God. Every meal we eat can be a reminder of this and more. Remember the fact that the words human, humus, you know, the top layer of soil, and humility all share the same Latin root is etymologically illustrative of the link made in Genesis 2 between the Adam and the Adama, right? In the Hebrew, the soil people come from the soil, and it's even more delicate than that. The words for soil and soil people have to do with the reddish-brownish tint of their skin. So they are the same color as the soil. And that was a huge point of the interesting Hebrew poetry there. And then the English words we get from this Latin root, humility, humus, and human all go together. As any farmer will tell you, no amount of technological innovation derived from the collective genius of humanity can make the soil bring forth life. We do not control whether or not a seed sprouts. I just planted some basil seeds a couple weeks ago. One out of the 10 seeds I planted came up. It doesn't matter how much I water all of them. I don't get to decide that. And I'm not sure that we think about that any longer as a society unless you're intimately involved in agriculture any longer. We do not make the seed sprout, nor do we make the sun shine or the rains deliver clouds. And the clouds deliver rain. This does not even take into account the hundreds of hands that it takes to bring food to us. This reality should shape us into humble beings who are grateful for the very meal on our table, or perhaps even the meal in our car. Being humble allows us to have knowledge of God. As one Old Testament scholar said, for Israelites, eating is a primary occasion for knowing the work of Yahweh. For those who draw near and offer themselves before God, satisfaction of hunger is neither an end in itself nor a holy secular event. In the ancient Israelite economy, eating is worshipful, it's even revelatory, because it engenders a healthy knowledge of who God is. As we think about that, I want us to consider that. You know, does the word, and that's what I tried to do in the previous chapter, to say the word steward doesn't lead us to humility any longer. We like to think of ourselves separate and distinct from everything else. But if we are reminded of where we're at on the food chain, we should even be more humble every day, because if the food chain crumbles below us, we're screwed. There's nothing we can do. And how would that lead us to different forms of farming, different forms of agriculture, and ultimately different forms of worship? Okay? And then number five of a bunch of others, but I'll stop at number five. Hopeful eating should remind us of a particular peculiarity. Humans are deeply moral creatures. As I mentioned just a moment ago, let me return to that story. The Apostle Paul is keenly aware of this in his admonition, or his admonishment rather, of those members of the Corinthian church who were making poor decisions about how much they ate and drank before their house church came together, and what those decisions were doing to harm other members of the church. Daily we engage in moral decision-making that allows us the opportunity to be either more or less Christ-like, especially when it comes to eating. Whether we care to admit it or not, Michael Pollan, the famous food journalist, I think is absolutely correct. He says, eating puts us in touch with all that we share with other animals and simultaneously all that sets us apart. It defines us for who we are. For the most part, and especially I think for many American Christians, we can decide what sort of food we want to place in our mouths on any given day. We can be strict carnivores, we can be vegetarians, or even vegans with a penchant for raw chocolate. We can decide whether or not to purchase food from a grocery store or the local farmer's market. We can choose between fair trade, organic products, or conventionally grown ones. All of these decisions shape us, some of us literally, into the persons we are, whether we consciously admit them or not. While there is perhaps no unadulterated, perfectly good moral choice to be made in any supermarket or from the list of your community-supported agriculture spring produce list, to neglect to recognize the food decisions we make every day shape us into vicious or virtuous people is foolhardy. These are not just individual decisions, as we have been marketed and advertised to believe, but ones that collectively shape our society as well. This makes them political decisions, too. Christians must make deliberate choices that signify the work of the Spirit through Jesus' resurrection, rather than implicitly and explicitly supporting a status quo that is permeated by so much violence, so much injustice and destruction, even if the choices are admittedly compromised ones or ones where we cannot always see the full consequences. Christians must manifest signs of hopeful eating in a world that seems trapped in hopeless eating, mired by presumption and despair. Okay? So as we think about ourselves and all the time that we spend eating, I think the larger sort of note is to ask ourselves, what kind of people are we turning into as we eat mindlessly? Do we turn into more Christ-like people, or do we turn into less Christ-like people? And I think that's a large sort of hurdle that we are going to have to overcome that was easy for the early Christian church. The early Christian church knew everything they did somehow turned them more into Christ or turned them away from Christ. And we have set up these sort of artificial walls and sort of saying, only these issues are the Christian ones, and these ones are not. When most of the time, we're spending our sort of mundane everyday lives doing things like eating. And those are actually forming us more into the people that we are than some of the quote-unquote big decisions that we're waiting for or may never come in our lives. Okay? All right, let me stop there just for a moment. Any questions or thoughts on that? Yes, please.
I think transfiguration is another thing that mm-hmm. I think in a way it's more Christian to emphasize foods that are grown close to us rather than ones that are transported clear across the world.
Yeah. I mean, and this is sort of the interesting piece of this, is not only does transportation have huge climate change implications, right? I asked, we have, I don't know. I haven't gone through the food line, but I'm guessing that there's the same kind of food that there is most of the year. There's melons and there's blueberries and some other things. And I ask my students during the school year, you know, where do those things come from? How many cantaloupes do you see being grown in California during January, even though we have cantaloupes every day? And most of them don't even know that the cantaloupe season is not in January because cantaloupes just magically appear wherever, right? And so you think about that and you say, well, where did that come from? Well, I don't know. So then I ask my students to go look and see where those cantaloupes or those pineapples or wherever. Some came from Mexico. Some come from Venezuela. You know, the blueberries come from Chile. The apples come from New Zealand. And so you ask the transportation question, you know, how many gallons of gasoline are being used to bring us food that is out of season? And is that making us more humble or less humble to think that we should have access to whatever we want whenever we want it? And instead of avoiding that question, I think it's important to just ask that question, which is, are something like the seasons of the planet ways for God to make us more in tune with what's going on and to teach us lessons of humility rather than to break out of those cycles and wonder what's going on? And so I find that to be a very interesting lesson for students because most of them have no idea that bananas are not actually grown in the U.S., right? But they've eaten bananas every day of their life, whether they're in Oklahoma, Arkansas, New York, or California, and have zero idea that there's not a plant, there may be a plantation of banana growers in California, but it is not something that we grow because we have the military might and the economic might to bring food from any other part of the world. And so in the food wastefulness section of the book, I talk a lot about how gluttony is a forgotten vice. It used to be one of the seven deadly sins. Protestants have sort of done away with gluttony, and we need to be more careful about how we consider gluttony. And gluttony is not just a sin of sort of eating too much. There were five different ways of thinking about gluttony in the Middle Ages. And I sort of return to that to get us to think about not just the eating too much. There's lots of other categories. And the one that I add to it is eating too cheaply a form of gluttony? We pay the least amount for any of the calories of any industrialized nation on the planet, and it has turned us into really interesting, wasteful people. So perhaps we need to think about eating calories that are a bit more expensive in order to appreciate them like the rest of the world does. And does that change our way of getting into food? And so maybe less Costco runs and more sort of living day to day would help us to understand the seasons better. It would help us to understand certain factors better. Now, I realize there's lots of poor folks and lots of other people around our, even in our country, that are food insecure. But the other piece of that would be, well, maybe Christians should be thinking about that when they're operating soup kitchens and such. The way that they eat maybe should be the same for the way that others should eat. And so our food budgets may have to be adapted to fit that sort of thing. I have a friend at a church in Chicago, and during the summertime, they've torn up a part of their parking lot, and they've turned it into a community garden. So during the wintertime, obviously in Chicago, real hard to grow vegetables for the soup kitchen that they run out of their church. But during the summertime, they can have fresh produce for people, and they do that. And they've said, God doesn't really call us to have parking lots. God calls us to have hope. And so I find even just something as simple as a community garden can bring hope to a community when you can share tomatoes. A friend of mine shared that they'll have their youth group classes out in the garden. So they'll teach them kind of what's going on and share that with some psalms or some other parts of scripture, but then remind them that the reason they do this is that they're bringing good news to a community. You know, a community that doesn't have fresh food and has to eat everything by can is not really the good news that God is inspiring. And so how do we understand that? So lots of different creative ways to do this. And this is not, and I spell this out much more clearly in the book, it can become very food-centric or food elitist in our culture to say that you're eating higher up on the food chain, but that's how perverted this has become, is that fresh fruit and fresh vegetables has become something that only the elite get and not the poor. And that's sort of how troubling the food system has become. And that you think that someone like me who doesn't freeze a lot of my food, I try to eat as fresh as possible and actually line up with the rest of the planet, somehow I'm the food elitist. Rather than sort of having a, I had a student come over the other day and she was looking through my pantry and I said, all right, Emily, what do you think? And she said, you don't have enough here. I was like, what do you mean I don't have enough here? She's like, it's amazing. You don't have a lot of stuff there. And I think I have too much there. You know, like we just, you know, buy cans when they're on sale or what have you. But that's the sort of immediate impact to sort of think about, you know, what is it that we're relating to? You know, is our dependence on God and we're preparing for other times, or do we need to, you know, prepare for every apocalyptic event that might come our way and have tons of stacks of stuff? I mean, those are interesting questions for us to consider. All right? So let me close here with a couple of things as we get to the end of our time. The last two chapters of the book go away from food and talk about the church as a possible beacon of hope. And the question that I'm going to leave with you rhetorically, and I'll just spell out in the last few minutes together, would you say that the church in your hometown or your home community is a beacon of hope for the rest of the community? And think about what a beacon is, right? A beacon is something that's on a hillside or it's out on a peninsula. And there's two different versions of a beacon, right? One is it sort of it casts out information to people in desperate times to know to sort of get away from the fire or watch out for the land. And so it casts out negative information like that, right? But it's also a navigational tool in the sense of beacons for centuries have been ways to lead ships one direction rather than the other. And so I try to use a lot of that metaphor and ask, are American churches still beacons in our communities? And it seems to me we're failing in that job pretty mightily, that we have engaged in so many tangential issues to the actual gospel message that people don't come to us with their heavy questions. They don't come to us with trusting ears about, can we decide which information we need to warn people about and which ways we can navigate people. And so what I suggest at the end of the book is these six ways that we need to consider ourselves as newfound beacons of hope. The first is, I call this section political involvement, and it's not a partisan section, but it's to ask ourselves the same question that the early Christians asked, which is, we are members of a nation state. We are political by just being part of a system of 315 or so, 100 million people. But we seem to think that only certain issues are political and some are not, right? Gay marriage, political issue. Healthcare, political issue. Eating, not a political issue. We've cast these sort of very artificial walls in between what we think is political and not, when the whole of our faith is political. I mean, Jesus died on a cross because a Roman Empire decided loving people was too dangerous to keep alive. So if we're living the same kind of message, our whole lives, our whole faith is political in that sense. And we're going to have to make some different decisions about that. The second one, I call seeking justice now, and ask the question, are we, as those oftentimes at the top of the food chain, have we sort of said, just wait, just wait, just wait, like the white moderates said to Martin Luther King early in the mid-20th century, right? Justice will come, just wait, just wait, just wait. Rather than doing what the gospel message seems to implore us to do, which is to seek justice for the widows, the orphans, and the aliens now. To walk humbly and show mercy now, not to wait until it is comfortable for us to do such. Third, I look at the idea of climate change denial, and I ask just this sort of simple question that is probably not as simple, which is climate change denial a sin? And as we've shifted to a new administration that has scrubbed all information from legitimate scientists, from governmental websites, I think this part of the chapter might be more interesting than it was a few months ago when I wrote it, or a year ago when I wrote it. And so I'm going to be very interested to see how churches respond to that idea. Is climate change denial a sin? And I go through lots of different psychological and sociological analyses of what denial is. So it's not just kind of a blanket statement, but there's different types of denial that we all engage in every day just to keep our heads in order. But when we're confronted with truth and we say it doesn't exist, who are we? Are we really truth-seeking God-fearers, or have we become something else? Okay. And then lastly, the last three, I was a scientist before I became a theologian. I was a biology major, and so science has been in my blood for as long as I can remember. And so the last chapter, I talk about three different ways that a church can be a beacon of hope. And I guess, and it's probably out of that bias that the church that I went to as a child told me I was going to hell for coming to Pepperdine. This was the place where godless people went. And then as soon as I said I was declared a biology as a major, I was definitely going to hell. So I had two strikes against me. I don't know which level of Dante's Inferno that puts me in, but it was a pretty bad strike. So the first piece of that sort of is a return to my youth. And I remind Christians that we need to support science and scientists. Christians and science have worked together for hundreds of years. really since Augustine. So about 1,600 years or so, Christians and scientists have had no problem with each other. It's been a contrived thing just in the last 100 years or so, where some Christians have said that some scientists will make your kids atheists, and so we have to get out of the science game. But the vast amount of scientists on the planet are not trying to convince your kids to be atheists. They're just trying to live their everyday life and find truth. And if there's no greater sort of calling than to find truth in the universe, I find that to be really troublesome. Anyway, talk a little bit about that. So supporting scientists, and particularly as climate denial folks have muddied and assassinated the character of many scientists, I find that to be really troubling that we as Christians can support those folks. Fifth, I say, talk about this idea of sacramental contemplation, which is sort of when you go up on a mountainside or you go into a valley and you see and you hear God, do we as Protestants think about that the way that our Roman Catholic and Orthodox brothers and sisters do? And so I talk about some ways of sort of reflecting on God's presence in the universe that Protestants have been kind of hands-off on that might actually make us more interested in what God's doing in this universe. And then lastly, and I'll close with this, the last section of the book is about our relationship to technology. And as I've said to lots of different classes, technology is going to help us get out of whatever depths of this crisis that we can get out. But we're going to pay for a lot of it anyway, because ice sheets are going to continue to melt, and water is still going to go up no matter how high we build our levees and dams and such. But the question, the larger theological question I ask, and I'll close on this, is, does the technology, whether it's in our pockets or that we are expecting to turn our cars into, will it make us more humble people, better servants, or will it make us more prideful and more hubristic? Will it cause us to think about our failures? Because we have vast failures with our technological successes, but we tend to be a species that is able to revel in successes and not remember our failures. And I think we have, as human beings and as Christians, we're supposed to remember both. We can't just sort of revel in the successes and forget the failures. For every cancer treatment that has helped my family, that same technology has created nuclear weapons. And we can't forget that. That is the ambiguity that is technology. It is used for good and it is used for ill. It either makes us prideful or it can make us more humble. And I think we have to ask that central question rather than just saying technology will be the savior that allows us to keep the same behavior that has caused these problems to begin with. Okay. All right, I've gone slightly over time, but thank you very much for your patience with me, and I'd be happy to take any questions afterwards. Thank you. God bless.